If you'd like to open your Bibles to 1 Samuel, the 12th chapter, the passage that was read in our presence a little earlier, we're going to be looking at that here in just a minute. But I have a few things I want to cover before we get to that. I was telling Stacy last night that a lot of the sermons I preach have like a 30-minute introduction followed by a 5-minute sermon, and that's exactly the way this one is. And so there's a lot of information here at the very beginning. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I appreciate the worship assembly we've had so far. Very, very good. Tabitha and I love traveling around. We love seeing people and meeting fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. And we've been looking forward to coming over here for a long time now. And we're thrilled to be here. Thrilled with the visitors we have. We have some visitors with us today. And I appreciate so much you being with us today. Anytime I start a series of lessons like this, there are two or three questions that everybody in the audience has. They're just too nervous to ask the question. And I started just trying to cover those questions at the very beginning because let's just get them out of the way so that we can concentrate on what we need to concentrate on. Now, these questions necessarily, they're not really biblical questions. They're just questions that people have. And questions are a good thing. When we stop asking questions, then we've kind of, I think, lost our way a little bit. We need to kind of continually ask questions so that we can learn things. So, let me go over these three questions. First question is this, and that is, what languages are spoken in Israel? That's a good question. And primarily, they speak Hebrew, Arabic, and English. I don't speak any Arabic. I speak a few words of Hebrew. But I've never really had any problem over there. If you've ever traveled internationally, you know this, but Americans, by and large, we know one language. People across the globe know multiple languages, and that's just kind of natural. This is probably something that us as Americans, we need to work on. We need to become more bilingual or trilingual. And this is one of those things. But over there in Israel, the Jewish people primarily speak Hebrew. The Arab people speak Arabic. And then English is widely known as well. And that kind of comes out in a lot of things that you see around there. For instance, here's a sign. I took this sign at a gas station near Beersheba. And you can see that everything is written in Hebrew on there. But it's pretty easy to understand what's going on. For those of you who want a math lesson and you want to look at this later, the prices there are listed as shekels per liter. So we do things in dollars per gallon. So shekels per liter, that's kind of an afternoon activity. You can go off and figure out what that is on your own. I'll tell you, it's probably not what you would think it would be. Israel is a very expensive place to live. And it comes out in that. You can see here, this is a sign outside of a theater in the city of Caesarea. We read about Caesarea in the book of Acts. But you can see here on the sign that you have Hebrew written, and then Arabic underneath it, and English underneath that. Here's a typical street sign in Israel. As you can see, all three languages are on there. And for the most part, most people over there can speak all three of these languages and do so frequently and almost going from one conversation to the other. It's a fairly easy thing for them to do. So that's one question that I get a lot. The second question is this, and I've actually already been asked this question since I came to the building this morning, that is, what kind of food do they have in Israel? And I will tell you unequivocally, they have very good food in Israel. People who travel with me, nearly everyone I've come up to me at some point in the trip thinking, boy, I thought I was going to lose weight on this trip. No, they have very, very good fruit food in Israel. Here is a salad bar at one of the places where we went. Salads are very, not only are they customary, but they're actually customary for breakfast. You'll have a huge salad bar set up for breakfast. We typically don't eat salads for breakfast. We typically have those in the lunch or dinner. But they eat salads very frequently for breakfast as well. And so you'll see beautiful salad bar set up. Fruit and agriculture in general in Israel is proficient. And I've had some of the best fruit I've ever eaten over in Israel. You can see here on this one, there's dates here and apples and cherries down here at the bottom and watermelon. I've had some of the best honeydew melon I've ever eaten over there in Israel. They have very, very good fruit and things like that. They have a lot of things that are very common to us, but maybe a little different. They have soft drinks and everything over there. This is a Coke written in Arabic on the side of the can there. They have this, but then they have a lot of things that are even more common. McDonald's is over there. The burgers are over there are good. In fact, here's a menu from a McDonald's near Beersheba. Beersheba is a Jewish city. And a couple of interesting things I want to point out about this. First of all, Hebrew, as well as Arabic, is a language that's read right to left. And so you'll see here's number one, number two, number three, number four. Everything is from right to left. And the other interesting thing about this is that you can purchase a hamburger in Israel, but you cannot purchase a cheeseburger in Israel. And the reason is because that goes against kosher law. We read in Leviticus about the mixing of dairy products and meat products in the same dish, and the Orthodox Jews still hold to that. And so you can get a hamburger, but you cannot get a cheeseburger. I mentioned in the class about that pizza place. I'm a huge meat lover's pizza fan. I love just pile the meat on there. I love that. I can't get that in Israel because you can't mix dairy, cheese, and meat on the same dish. A lot of the meats that they have over there, when you go in for a dinner at a hotel or something, they'll have beef and lamb and fish and chicken, all kind of things. The one thing that they don't have that we're all accustomed to is pork. Pork is against not only Jewish law, but also Islamic law. And so it's very, very difficult, not impossible, but very, very difficult to eat pork in Israel. And so for someone like me, I never realized how much pork I actually consume until I'm dropped into a location where I cannot get it. But let me just tell you, I eat a lot of pork. And whether that's ham or bacon or, you know, barbecue pork. And usually when I arrive back in the United States, Tabitha will pick me up at the airport, and before we even come to the house, we'll stop through Lawler's so I can get me a barbecue sandwich. I've got to get that back in my bloodstream so I start feeling normal again. But overall, the food is very, very good over there. The third question is this, and I get this question a lot. Is it safe to travel in Israel? I kind of chuckle a little bit. I'm a fairly sarcastic person. And so a lot of times when someone asks me this, I laugh a little bit because there's almost an implication that I would be going somewhere or taking people somewhere that is not safe. And the truth of the matter is it's very safe in Israel. In fact, there's a lot of places in Israel I would travel that I wouldn't travel the same way here in the United States. It's just that you can do that. But I understand why people ask this question. And the reason is because people get their information from the news. And the news typically shows pictures like this of people struggling. There's some argument and everything. Or you'll see a picture like this where there's some sort of riot. The truth of the matter is that those things happen all over the world. They happen here in the United States as well. And I don't want to be too critical of news, but the news are all about ratings, and quite frankly, good news doesn't, sadly enough, bring the ratings. And so, a lot of times, even if you watch our local news here, you rarely do you see a news about a county fair or something like that. It's usually about a robbery at a convenience store or something like that. And so if you're only given that amount of information, you can get the wrong impression about a country. The truth of the matter is that Israel is incredibly safe. I mean, the news doesn't tell you about this, what's going on right here. I took this picture one morning, early in the morning, about 6:45, out by the Western Wall. And what you see there are young boys, Jewish boys, praying at the wall. And that's because for Orthodox Jewish boys, learning how to pray is part of their education. Now, I may not believe everything that Jewish people believe, but as a parent, there's probably a lesson in that for me. That before you learn writing and arithmetic, you teach your kids how to pray. That's a valuable lesson that we can learn. But that's not reported on the news. The beautiful sunrises over the Sea of Galilee. That's never reported on the news. I mean, sunrises are beautiful anywhere. Tabitha and I live in eastern Limestone County, and right across the field from us, street from us, is this beautiful cotton field. And you know, in October when it's white, sun comes up, it's beautiful. Sunrises over the Sea of Galilee are just beautiful. They are. Every time I see a sunrise like this, I think about the disciples who have been out there fishing all night. I'm sure they saw this exact same sunrise every time. But these are things that you know, the news doesn't report about this. The news doesn't report about the bumper wheat crop that they have in Israel. Agriculture is huge in Israel, big. And when you drive around the country, there's just, you know, farm after farm after farm after farm of growing different things. I took this picture on the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley a number of years ago. Beautiful wheat crop. They don't talk about that. The news doesn't talk about the opening of ski season in Israel. This is a picture of Mount Hermon on the northern end of Israel. Mount Hermon is mentioned in Scripture as well. The top of Mount Hermon is over 9,000 feet in elevation. There's a huge ski resort on the top of Mount Hermon. But the news doesn't talk about the opening of ski season in Israel. So that's just some of the things that you don't think about too much. But those are some questions that I typically get, just kind of random questions about traveling over there. And so I like to kind of just cover those and let everybody know that. Okay, let's talk about what we need to talk about this morning. And what I want to concentrate on is I want us to learn about the land of Israel. And I'm going to do that by talking about the land. And then we want to go back and look at this passage in 1 Samuel, the 12th chapter. Because I believe that knowing and understanding biblical geography helps you to understand passages a little bit more. And, you know, it's not necessarily a requirement, but I think we should all try to learn as much as we can about God's Word. And that includes the geography, because it really does kind of enhance some of the stories. So let's talk about the land, for instance. During the time of the Bible, most, not all, but most people lived within the framework of this map that I have in front of me. And you have Europe up here in the upper left, you have Asia in the upper right, and you have, of course, Africa down here in the lower left. Now, in Genesis, the 12th chapter, God made a promise to Abraham. Part of that promise was that He was going to give His people a land. Now, God is God. God could have given Abraham's family any piece of land across the planet. But for some reason, He gave them this little narrow stretch of land right here. And so I'm forced to ask the question, why? Why that piece of land? Well, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not God. But I like to think about it. I mean, to the west of this piece of land, you have the Mediterranean Sea. And during the time of the Bible, you had naval activity out on that sea. But if you were going to migrate a large group of people, you probably would not have done it over the sea. And to the east of this piece of land, you have a lot of desert. Again, you could go across that, but if you had a large group of people, you probably wouldn't cross that. So what you have is this narrow 40 to 50 mile wide corridor of land through here that became a land bridge between three continents. And so as people would go from one continent to another, they'd be forced to come through that land. And as they did, they would be able to see the crops and see the animals and see the houses and see the people. And they might be tempted to ask the question, who is your God that blesses you in such a way? And that would provide an opportunity for the children of Israel to talk about Jehovah. And as they did, and as these people traveled, word of Jehovah could be spread throughout the known world at that time. So perhaps that's why God put His people in this exact location. A little side comment. Where has God placed you? Are you in this city or this congregation or this county or this state for a specific reason that God has put you here? So that you would have opportunities to talk to others about God? Just something to think about. But that could be why God's people were here. And so let's take a closer look at this land. This land is an incredibly interesting land from a geographical perspective. It's incredibly small. In fact, if you were to take the entire land of Israel, like from Dan to Beersheba that we read about in the Bible, you could place it in the northwest corner of Alabama. You know, if you use the Alabama-Mississippi line and the Alabama-Tennessee line and maybe I-65 all the way down to Birmingham and then come across to the Mississippi-Alabama line, if you took that, that would be about the size of Israel. It's incredibly small. But within that, you've got some incredibly different geographical differences. So for instance, starting here on the eastern, on the western side, you have the coastal plain. This is about a 10-mile wide piece of land that's, as you would think, fairly flat. It's called the coastal plain because it lines up against the Mediterranean coast. The Philistines lived in the coastal plain. Cities like Caesarea and Joppa, they were in the coastal plain. As you move a little bit farther to the east, what you have is the hill country. Now, the coastal plain is nice and flat. The hill country, of course, is exactly as described. It's incredibly hilly. Many of the cities within the coastal, within the hill country are well over 2,000 feet in elevation. There's very few cities in Alabama that are 2,000 feet. But, you know, cities like Hebron, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Shiloh, even Nazareth up in the lower Galilee area, they're all part of in the hill country. Coming to the little farther east than that, you have the Jordan Rift Valley. Now, this is a very thin valley, about 10 miles, 8 to 10 miles wide. Now, everywhere in this valley on this map is below sea level. The Jordan River sits about 700 feet below sea level, below the surface of the Mediterranean Sea. And then you have the Jordan River through there and leads down to the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is 1,350 feet below sea level. It's the lowest place on the face of the earth. And so you have these huge geographical differences. Farther east than that, you have the Transjordan Plateau. This is in the modern country of Jordan. The land rises dramatically and then flattens out across that plain. Now, you may have noticed there's a couple of areas here that are missing. That I haven't colored in. Up here at the top, we have the Jezreel Valley. Knowing what you know now about the hill country, I will tell you that east-west passage across the land is not very easy because of these high mountains in the middle, with the exception of the Jezreel Valley. The Jezreel Valley allows you to go east-west across the land very, very easily. Then there's another part of land down here at the bottom called the Shephelah. Now, Shephelah is not a word that we use very much. It's a Hebrew word, and in our English Bibles, most of the time it's translated as lowlands. And so you'll see that written in Scripture, the lowlands. But this was an area which with wider valleys, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in a future lesson. But it's an area that was prominent during the time of the United Kingdom. For instance, with the Philistines living out here in the coastal plain and the Israelites living in the hill country, the Shephelah became the battleground area between those two nations. The famous story of David and Goliath in the Elah Valley. The Elah Valley is in the Shephelah. And so that kind of gives you an idea of what these, of the different geographical areas that are in the country. Now, I want you to do a mental exercise with me. I want you to kind of draw a line across this land and cut it in half and then kind of lay it on its back. So you're looking at kind of an elevation profile. And when you do, it'll look something like this. So what you have here is the Mediterranean Sea and the coastal plain rising up into the hill country, going down into the Jordan Rift Valley before it rises dramatically again and flattens off across the Transjordan Plateau. Now, when you have wide variety of geography like this, it makes for some interesting weather. Now, let me tell you a little secret. I met my wife at Florida State University, and we both got our degrees in meteorology. That's how we met. She was the only girl in the class, so I had a lot of competition, but I won. I got her. But we both have our degrees in meteorology, so we love talking about the weather. So let's talk about the weather for a second. For the most part, during the year, winds blow off of the Mediterranean Sea, and when they do, cold air rises, or this warm air rises when it hits the mountains, and clouds form. We see that often here in the summertime here in Alabama. Once the clouds get big enough and thick enough and the water weighs too much, it falls as rain. And so a lot of rain falls here in the hill country. A lot of rain falls in there. Now, as those winds continue to blow toward the east, those clouds go down into the Jordan Rift Valley and they warm and they evaporate. So the area down in the Jordan Rift Valley doesn't get very much rain. So let's look at this. You have a city like Jerusalem. Jerusalem sits at the very top of the hill country at 2,700 feet in elevation, and they get 26 inches of rain per year. So what does that mean, 26 inches of rain per year? Well, according to what we think, that's not a lot of rain. I mean, it's a lot of rain, but here in North Alabama, we average between 50 and 60 inches of rain per year. And so they get about 26 inches of rain per year. Now, let's think about this a little bit. Let's compare this, though, to somewhere else in the world, like, for instance, London. Now, we all know that it rains all the time in London. Here's another little secret. My favorite movie of all time is The Sound of Music with Julie Andrews. My second favorite movie of all time is Mary Poppins. Again, I get if Julie Andrews were to walk through that back door, I'd probably go and hug her right now. I guess I'm a huge fan. But when Mary Poppins showed up at the Banks home, she had two things with her. She had a carpet bag and she had an umbrella. Why'd she have the umbrella? And the reason is because it always rains in London. It's always raining in London. Well, London gets about 28 inches of rain per year. Jerusalem gets almost as much rain as London does. But we don't think about it that way, because a lot of times we think about Israel as it's just this dry desert. And that's not the case at all. There are parts of the land that are dry, but that's not the case. But Jerusalem gets 26 inches of rain. But remember what I said about the winds and the clouds and the rain falling. It's not going to show up on my screen here. Jericho sits right down here at the base of the, down in the Jordan Rift Valley. Jericho is, as the crow flies, 15 miles from Jerusalem. And Jericho gets 4 inches of rain per year. And it all has to do with geography. Jericho is located 850 feet below sea level. So try to imagine this. Try to think of a location that's 15 miles east of here, but imagine it if it was 3,500 feet lower in elevation than we are here. That's the difference between Jericho and Jerusalem. I mean, as you're riding in a car from Jericho to Jerusalem or from Jericho up to Jerusalem, your ears pop because you're changing elevation so fast. I mean, you're really climbing in that time. And so you have areas in which Jerusalem gets a lot of rain per year. And just 15 miles away, Jericho gets 4 inches of rain per year. Okay. Now that you've got all that kind of crammed in your head temporarily, let's open up our Bibles to 1 Samuel, the 12th chapter, because there's a story here that's incredibly interesting, but you have to know a little bit about the geography and the climate of Israel for it to have its full impact. Let me set this up. In 1 Samuel, the 12th chapter, Samuel is getting old, and they're in the process of installing Saul as the king, and Saul and the men have gone up to Jabesh-Gilead to fight because there's a problem up there. And they go up there and solve that problem. And they've come back and they've encamped at Gilgal. Now Samuel is getting old, and so he's got some things that he wants to tell the people because he didn't think he's going to be around much longer. And they're at Gilgal. Now Gilgal is very close to Jericho. And so with that being said, he starts talking in 1 Samuel 12, beginning in verse 1. He says, Samuel said to all of Israel, Behold, I have obeyed your voice in all that you have said to me and have made a king over you. And now, behold, the king walks before you and I am old and gray, and behold, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Here I am. Testify against me before the Lord and before his anointed. whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify against me, and I will restore it to you. And they said, you have not defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hand. And he said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and against his and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. And they said, he is witness. So he starts off this talk by saying, I've got some important things I want to tell you. But before I do, I want to make sure that you're going to listen to me. And I want to make sure that none of you have anything against me. And he said, he asked these questions, who have I defrauded? And they all say, no, you haven't defrauded us. You're good. We're ready to listen to you. And he says, okay, as God is my witness, I'm going to talk to you. So then he continues in verse 6. Samuel said to the people, the Lord is witness, who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your fathers out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous deeds of the Lord that he performed for you and your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and the Egyptians oppressed them, then your fathers cried out to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. But they forgot their God. And he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against him. And they cried out to the Lord and said, we have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and Ashtaroth. But now deliver us out of the hand of your enemies that we may serve you. So Samuel's teaching them a little history lesson there. He's reminding them about what God has done for them over the centuries. You were oppressed. You were here. You prayed out to God. God sent people to save you. And this happened over and over and over again. Every time you have had trouble, God has been there for you. So he continues. Verse 11, the Lord sent Zerubbabel and Barak and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies and on every side, and you lived in safety. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall rule over us, when the Lord your God was your king. And now behold, the king whom you have chosen, for whom you have asked, behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and will not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. So he says here, despite what God has done for you continually over the centuries, you ask for a king. However, God granted your wish, and he gave you a king. And if you do what you're supposed to do, if you and your king obey God, then all will be well. But if not, then there's going to be problems. And then we get to verse 16, which was the verse that was read for us here in our assembly. Verse 16 says, now therefore stand still and see the great thing the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call upon the Lord that he may send thunder and rain. And you shall know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking for yourselves a king. So Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. It's an incredible story here. And it says that when the thunder and rain came, the people were greatly amazed. And so I'm forced to ask the question, why did the people react this way? And I can think of three reasons. First reason, God had made it thunder and rain. I mean, can you imagine what this scene would have looked like? Samuel's sitting there talking to them, and he says, I along with God, we're going to send thunder and rain, and immediately it starts thundering and raining. I mean, can you imagine what that would have looked like? I mean, that's incredible, just that in itself. And so I think this is one of the reasons why the people were so amazed. But I think there's another reason. And the other reason is God not only made it thunder and rain, but he made it thunder and rain at a place where it rarely rains. Remember about what I said about where they are? They're in Gilgal. Now, we don't know the exact location of Gilgal because it was never a fortified city like Jericho, but it was located approximately 3 to 5 miles northeast of Jericho, down in the base of the Jordan Rift Valley. And remember what we said there? Jericho gets about 4 inches of rain per year. So not only did God make it thunder and rain, but He made it thunder and rain at a place that rarely gets rain. And the people were impressed. It made an impact. But I think there's another reason why this was so impactful. But before I can do that, I need to tell you one other piece of information. Did you see this question that Samuel asked in the middle of his sermon? This is such an odd question to ask in the middle of all this. It seems to be totally unrelated to everything he's talking about. He asks, "Is it not the wheat harvest today?" Why in the world would he ask that question? He's trying to make a point. And the point's this. If you were to look at how rainfall falls in Israel, it's very, very interesting. I mentioned that the city of Jerusalem gets about as much rain as London does. And if you were to graph this out, he used the word nerd or geek earlier, and he's exactly right. I'm a map and numbers geek. But if you were to graph this out, this is inches of rain, and here are the months of the year down here. The rainfalls in Jerusalem that looks like this. We read about this in Scripture. We read about the early rains and the latter rains. The early rains fall in October and November. The latter rains fall in March and April. God told the people they were going to have early rains and latter rains in Israel, and He's still doing that, you know, 3,000 years later. But this is how the rainfall falls in Israel. The very first tour, and so it doesn't rain at all between May and October. Never. The very first tour I led to Israel was in June. And people contacted me before we left. They said, "What do we need to take as far as rain gear?" And I said, "Nothing." And they said, "Are you some sort of smart aleck weather guy?" And the answer to that is yes. But I was being truthful. There was no reason to take any rain gear because it has not rained in June in Israel in 2,000 years, and it's not going to do that next year when we're there. And it didn't. We didn't hardly even see a cloud the whole time. Now, remember, these people are in Gilgal. They're near Jericho. And so here's how the rain comes for Jericho. It's the same distribution, just much less. So let's think about Samuel's question. Is it not the wheat harvest today? So when is the wheat harvest? Well, the wheat harvest is in June. So why did the people react this way? Well, they reacted this way because God had made it thunder and rain. And God had made it thunder and rain at a place that rarely gets rain. And God had made it thunder and rain at a place that rarely gets rain at a time of year in which it never rains. And the people were amazed at God and Samuel. See how understanding a little bit about geography and about climate helps these stories kind of come alive? I mean, I've read through that passage I don't know how many times, but once I understood what Samuel's actually doing here, it was that much more powerful. You know, at where we worship at Capshaw, sometimes we'll have a little kids class, and they'll sing a song that says, "My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do." And that's true. My God can make it rain and take it from somebody who studied the weather. That's not easy to do. But the good news for all of us is that the same God who made it rain there and who makes it rain here all the time loves you and me and wants us to follow Him. And so that's the lesson that I want you to take with you today. I appreciate so much your attention this morning. You have been an excellent audience, and I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to our other lesson together. But if there's any need that you have to follow Jesus, follow God, we ask you to come to the front. while we stand and while we sing.